Okay, great. So welcome everybody. So we'll start off first with announcements. Does anybody have announcements that they'd like to make?
I know Lynn Cherry won't be here today because she's talking in my kid's school.
Appropriate.
Indeed.
The one thing I'll say is, Karen Holwig was the first to put it out that the framework is going to turn into the draft standards on the 11th. And the comments will be due by June 1st.
Yeah.
So one thing the network may want to think about is a network response to the draft that's coming out.
Yeah, I think this is, Tamara, given my schedule, the only way that we'll be able to do that is if we can do it quickly the week following. And so I might put out a poll to see who can – might not be able to. Maybe we can do it next week on the Climate Literacy Network call, but we can talk about that. Would that work for people if we did it next week, the 15th, or are people going to be away and maybe we have to get multiple responses? I just want to get a sense of those who are on the phone.
Yeah, I'll be away on the 15th.
That's Don.
I'm actually going to a conference about the next generation standards on the 15th.
Right, me too.
You're going to be going to a meeting about it?
Yes.
Okay.
So maybe one thing to think about here is how would we, I mean, we don't actually have to all talk about it, but I would imagine we may need some way of sharing our comments. We're not may have all of us having to make the same comments over and over again, but just, you know, maybe there's a way to do it in a document form.
How about we set up a wiki?
Yeah, something like that.
Actually, why don't we, I'll do a set up a Google Docs. We can do it there.
Yeah, that's a good idea.
All right, we'll set that up.
Amber, this is Scott. I just want to remind you that we do have a presentation next week on the 15th.
Okay.
Snyder. And I actually, in fact, I sent an email to Karen suggesting that maybe we would do something on the 22nd. I know you're going to be away, but we both the 22nd and the 29th of May are telecon, schedule, and they're both open at this point. But I kind of agree with you. It's kind of like we want to get into this early because Karen, I think, knows what's in there, but the rest of us don't. And I would really like to sort of have a chance to really think about this before we send our comments in. So maybe we
we can set up a Google Docs for the next week, and then you can have a conversation where that could serve as feed input into the conversation.
Yeah, I think that's a great way to do it. And then we can use our email and obviously the shared document to pull some comments together, and as Frank says, not to replicate each other, just simply to make it very strong set of comments coming from a large group of people from the network rather than from our individual organizations.
And the only other thing I'll say on this is that this does not preclude any individual of the network
right.
for sending in their individual comments, but just
absolutely.
Maybe the network would hold some weight as a combined statement as well.
I think that was the argument we made, I think, when we reviewed the framework itself.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. Okay. Other announcements? Well, I just wanted to let – I mentioned this at the beginning, but I'll let everybody know that we had a clean review camp here the past day and a half at Turk. I don't – exactly know how many resources we looked at, but we've passed another 113 with a good chunk, like on the order of 57 sent to the editorial board. So a good fraction of those will also be accepted into the collection. So we are moving forward, and we engaged a whole new group of educators and scientists here in the Boston area.
Excellent.
Tamara, I hate to go backwards, but I joined the call late, and I just want to make sure that you're going to post or send out to everybody the instructions that you just completed discussing about the comments on the...
Oh, yeah, sure.
Yeah, okay.
When we set up the Google Docs, I'll send out the instructions for how
Great.
We're going to proceed on that.
Thanks.
Excellent.
Okay. Any other announcements? Okay, if not, we're going to move on to our panel discussion. This is a new method of sharing and communicating in the Climate Literacy Network that we're trying for the first time. So everybody hopefully has been online and gotten the slides. Don Dugenhaus, David Lustig, and Luis Huffman are going to address with a few slides the question of how can or do we facilitate interactions between formal and informal educators to the benefit of both personally and in their teaching? And so I'd like to start with Don and have him go through his slides. We'll move on to each panelist. If there's a burning question you have, you can try to let us know. What we'd like to do is to get through the presentations it's potentially you can have some interaction between the panelists, but then to open it up to a general discussion for everybody who's on the call. So, Don, you want to start with your slides?
Sure. So I've just really got a couple of slides with anything at all on them, and they're brief. There's a title slide, and then the second slide has images of our bookmarks for two of our projects, though three different websites. The first two are really related to the same NSFDR K-12 project, which is a five-year grant that we're in our fourth year of now, which is the goal of it is to help educators teach about local and regional earth system science in an inquiry-based way. And the lion's share of our participants in the professional development part of that program are middle school and high school earth science teachers. But we've increasingly, we'll end up working with a total of 10 cohorts by the time the project's over next year. And as we've moved through, we've sprinkled in more and more informal educators. Working together with us. Most of those folks are doing teacher professional development, so that's not the one I want to focus, not the project I want to focus on the most, but I'll probably say about that much about it. The third bookmark image there, the Marcellus Shale project or Marcellus Shale Outreach, we actually have a number of projects related to that, and one of them is the Marcellus Shale Educator Professional Development Project, where we're working with targeted communities who face an emergent energy issue, and it ended up being Marcellus Shale in both of the communities that we're working with, which is more or less what we anticipated, but we were open to some community wrestling with what to do with windmills, for example. And the idea there is a community-focused approach where we engage as many different kinds of educators who are working on Marcellus Shale or energy-related issues. Pardon me? Okay. Working together. So in our Elmira cohort, which is our first cohort, which we're kind of winding down with them and winding up with our Binghamton area cohort, the Elmira area cohort has several museum educators, college faculty, three Elmira College faculty, and one Corning Community College faculty member. And the Elmira College faculty include a humanities professor who part of his research includes studying how people respond to landscape and landscape imagery, environmental science professor who has done research in groundwater contamination, and a philosophy professor who's developing an environmental ethics course. And the humanities and the environmental science professor are the co-directors of their environmental studies program. We have in that group also a classroom teacher who teaches conservation biology, and the Nature Center director of the Tanglewood Nature Center in Elmira. And what we're one of the outcomes of the project is intended to be developing sort of a heuristic approach for communities to deal with emergent energy issues. So whether it's Marcellus Shale being proposed in the area or a new wind farm or maybe a nuclear plant, there's a series of related issues that tend to arise very quickly, tend to be very polarizing, and tend to run into the huge obstacle that most people don't really have much of a clue as to where their energy comes from. So we're still somewhat early in the project, but the Elmira cohort is kind of wrapping up, and the outcomes of that look like we will work together with all of the 12 educators in the project, or many of the 12 educators in the project, to run a two-day workshop this summer for teacher professional development. And at least one of the informal institutions is going to be developing an exhibit, the Wings of Eagles Discovery Center, which historically was a World War II aircraft museum that's transforming itself into more of a science center, is developing an exhibit on the Marcellus, and we are looking into collaborating and having three complementary exhibits, one at our museum, the Museum of the Earth in Ithaca, that would look at the Marcellus underground, essentially. The Tanglewood Nature Center would have an exhibit on the effects at and near the surface, and the Wings of Eagles would play to their expertise and look at remote sensing and what it looks like from above to and the science used to understand from a spatial sense from satellite and aerial imagery. That's more in the thinking stage right now, but I hope it's going to happen. I think most importantly, the sort of shadow outcome or something like that is that we've networked these educators in a fairly small community who really hadn't interacted with one another very much, and we think that that will lead to future collaborations down the line. So looking at the last slide, and specific to the question we were posed, The connections between informal and formal have been growing steadily over time. We've done separately professional development for teachers for as long as we've been doing educational outreach. And in the last, probably starting about 6 or 7 years ago, we started doing informal educator professional development for museum educators. And we've seen some cross-cutting elements that apply to anybody, and we've seen advantages of getting these folks talking to one another. Talking about how we do it, well, we go hunting. We make cold calls to people and say, how does this sound to you? Do you want to talk to other educators in your community who are in a different sector and work together on relevant issues for your community, and we're very explicit about the importance of networking. And in all of the work that we've done in this, we've seen lasting relationships between informal and formal educators, and general just a delight in terms of connecting these folks one to another if they weren't connected already. And of course, many of them knew each other to some degree, but hadn't really worked on any collaborative projects. So I think that's enough of an overview, unless somebody wants to throw a question at me, or do we want to go on to whoever's next?
Why don't we go on to David Lustig for next?
Thank you. Thanks, Don. That was really helpful. I also love hearing about my old stomping grounds in the southern tier of New York. I know exactly all the places you're talking about. I love the fact that you're doing all that work and facilitating all of that learning and utilizing the local resources for promotion of learning and science. I think it's just great. What a great project you're getting yourself that you're working on.
It has a downside, but he wants to shoot us, of course. From
pardon?
Side. It has the downside that everybody wants to shoot us, of course, from both sides.
Well, I was just waiting for you. The only thing I was waiting for was an exhibit on fracking.
Yeah, well, that's really what we're talking about. And I should have said that we have essentially promised the NSF that we won't take a position on it.
I heard the subtext. I thought it was very interesting.
Yeah,
so
go ahead, Dave.
Well, our work is we're working here out of Lowell, Massachusetts. And one of the things I realized looking over the notes in preparation for this of the other presenters was that our focus is exclusively on adult learners. We are not that's our primary focus of the end result of everything. Our goal is to foster learning about climate change among adults. So if you go to my second slide, we had a conference in October that brought together people interested from very diverse backgrounds and expertise to look at ways to use out-of-home media in informal settings to foster science learning. And our primary locale or context was public transportation. How do we use mass transit spaces to provide opportunities for science learning, particularly about climate change science? And we brought together a lot of people to look at this question and wrestle with the technology, the experience that's been involved in working in out-of-home media, being posters, placards, billboards, as we've all seen this week from the Heartland Institute. They can be a very powerful medium for dispersing information at a relatively low cost and extremely efficient, productive timescale. So there are a lot of advantages to this, and we wanted to bring people together to find out what others thought. And we, if you go to the next slide, we brought together people from all over the country, and we had an international speaker from England come via Skype to talk about experiences from a communications point of view and advertising and all the emerging technologies that are going into technology for out-of-home media. There's really a revolution going on. We had people from informal science ed from the Boston Museum of Science talking about how the museum as an institution is addressing climate change learning and the strategies and ideas that they are trying to promote. We had science educators there from school systems talking about their experiences teaching in informal classrooms. And we had researchers from science communications and and specifically the psychology of climate change. It was a great meeting and very productive. And to me, if you go to the third slide, it's about this, what I call the golden triangle, where we bring these three groups together to understand the specific challenges associated with adults learning about climate change in our society. And the primary outcome was we expect to begin a project in July that will focus on the bus system in Lowell, Massachusetts. And what we've done with this particular project, which is different than our other projects, is we have included a very strong component to public education, whereas instead of an ad agency developing all of the media for the buses, we are going to ask students K through 16 to develop artwork associated with a specific concept from climate change. And we'll be coordinating with the teachers and the students, and our goal is to get teachers to include climate change science in their curriculum, so because it's not a part of what teachers are doing in classrooms in this area. And it's in terms of the Merrimack Valley and the local Lowell District, it's not part of the curriculum. So to us, this is very important. We see this as a very simple, clear way of engaging students with art and explaining a very specific concept in climate change. And then, as incentives, we've got prizes, and we've got a board to help select the winners, and we hope to involve through a series of networks that are established in Massachusetts, communication for publicity until we get as many students in classrooms at all levels involved as possible. And so by January of 2013, we hope to start running our ads, and we're going to conduct a study to determine over a six-month period what is it that people learn from this media campaign in terms of what are the science outcomes, what are the if there are any changes in opinion or beliefs about climate change, about specific misconceptions about climate change. We will be able to measure how many people are motivated to engage with the ads and with our website. And so we're pretty excited to make this, to see this happen.
Okay, thank you very much. We'll quickly move on to Louise, and then we will have questions and conversations. So go ahead, Louise.
Okay, so I'm Louise Huffman. I'm the coordinator of education outreach for ANDRIL, which is Antarctic Geological Drilling. And if you look at the second slide, it's interesting that we're having this call today because I'm in Lincoln at the ANDRIL Science Management Office with our NOAA grant evaluator. We have a grant for climate education or environmental literacy with called Climate Change Student Summits, and we just had our final summit of a five-year program on April 28th. So we're together, and I'm also here with that Susan Lenz is our evaluator, and Jean Pennycook is our one of our curriculum developers for the environmental literacy framework materials. So we're here to this week looking back over the past 5 years and evaluating this project. So it's kind of good to have to look at some of the things that we've done through this project. ANDRIL also has a lot of education outreach pieces that are not contained just in the C-squared, S-squared project, but trying to put all these things together. If you go to the second slide, one of the things that I tried to do in my own head was compare formal and informal education and really define those terms in light of how we have approached some of our education outreach projects. And so just real quickly, you can look at that Venn diagram and see some of the things. But I think I was at the International Polar Year Science Conference 2 weeks ago and talking to some of the scientists there about education outreach. So some of these ideas actually came out of a couple of those conversations. And I think looking at formal education, when scientists or climate change educators go into classrooms and talk about climate change, those students are usually near the same age. The teachers have prepared them for the visit. The students often have some background knowledge. You kind of know exactly how long your presentations are going to run. Whereas if you're in an informal situation, the audience can be a huge mix of ages. They may have no background about the science, and your presentations often have to be very snappy and quick because they vote with their feet and leave if they're not real interested. And again, that depends on the program and how it's set up within those venues. They all have challenges. They require preparation. There's a huge opportunity in both for communicating. So if you look at the next slide, the formal education side of what we do, our scientists are very much involved in the education outreach with ANDRIL. So scientists go out to classrooms. They're very involved when we work at a museum venue and are involved in an exhibit. The scientists are there. I go into classrooms and work with teachers and more students. Teachers come to workshops and then go into their classrooms and use our materials. So there's a lot of different ways that we work within the formal education venues. If you go to the next slide with informal education, these are just a couple of examples of how students have taken the materials that we present. We coined a phrase called flexibits or flexible exhibits. The students learn about climate change by building the models and doing the activities, but then they can take those same models and the videos and the posters and they become the teachers and the scientists presenting it to other audiences. So these are just some examples of places where some of these flexibles have taken, have come to life. And if you look at the next slide, one of the things that we've found is that museums have been very welcoming to our scientists and to the students coming in and putting on flexibles. So we've had, you can see some of the different venues there, pictures from different places with scientists, but we also have students in these places presenting the materials along with the scientists. And the next slide, the intersections between formal and informal education have happened on a lot of different in a lot of different ways. With teacher professional development workshops and our climate summits, we have lots of museum partners. They've provided marketing for the workshops and for the summits. They've provided their own networks of teachers to invite to these. They provide the space, some of the materials, sometimes food and parking. Andrew provides the resource materials, scientists and facilitators to come in and lead those workshops. We've also been involved with special events, which kind of brings students from the formal ed side into the informal side where they're putting on these flexibles. We've had presenters, both students, teachers, and scientists who are presenting to general audiences at these special events, and that lists a couple of them, a couple of different events that we've been involved in. And then a lot of the venues, the informal venues, have also helped us with being involved in webinars and video conferences, and that technology piece has also been a really good thing that the informal side has brought. So the last slide, just some of the lessons learned, and I think probably one of the things for me is that the lines between the formal and the informal have really blurred. I think it was David who said that Don, where you were talking about the informal and formal workshops, that presenting it to the different people within those workshops, whether it's formal or informal, the presentation often can be the same. What we've found when working, a lot of our workshops include both formal education teachers and informal educators, and we've presented the material with them. We've provided scientists to help build their background knowledge. We give them the same materials. But then when you have a mixed group of the formal and informal educators, we've given them time then to talk about how their approaches would be different in their situations. And so the presentation and the training of the educators has been very similar, and yet then together we can kind of talk about how they might approach it in their own situation. So we've had kind of a wide reach to aquariums, to museum situations, 4-H clubs, all kinds of informal types of education situations. So some of the lessons you can see in this this comparison, one interesting thing that we've found with our summits is that the students take a lot of this home to their parents. So one of the things that we hadn't thought about was that influence on the parents from the students. But you also get that in the informal side, because if students are coming to a program, they're maybe self-selected, but they have to have parent buy-in for them to be a part of that program, for the parents to get them there. And so there's some interesting things that we've just kind of thinking back on it. This was a nice thing for me to kind of have to go back and really look at and see what is it that we really have learned. But I guess the biggest thing is that those lines have blurred a lot, that we can include both in our professional development types of activities. We get a lot from working with the different informal venues, and have our scientists also in the museums. One of the things that we're finding is that they welcome the scientists to be there to talk to their audiences, but they also, our scientists are able to inform their exhibits. When they're looking at a new exhibit, for example, for climate change or on the polar regions, our scientists can inform that and provide the scientific resources and data that they're looking for. So that's about it, I think.
Okay, well, thank you very much. So I have some questions, but I think I'll open it to the floor first. Were there any questions from the participants out there?
I had a question back on the first presentation. I just wanted to clarify with Dawn that I believe what you were describing today, the focus was on community problem solving, primarily mm-hmm. around the energy issues.
Right.
Is that right? And is that
yeah, that's right.
Okay, so that's the kind of heuristic you're interested in
right.
developing, is along the community problem solving line.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yeah, and we are working. We have a magnetic pull or something towards controversial issues, and the Museum of the Earth is really built around evolution. We've for years been working in climate change. Now we're working on fracking, and we're in the process of merging with the Cayuga Nature Center and are going to be looking at deer management because we just want to irritate people. But really, I was talking with my colleague Rob Ross, who some of you know anyway, this weekend about that. And really, I think we're drawn to those controversial issues because they're problems, that people understand in fundamentally different ways. People tend not to know how to talk to one another about it and gravitate towards poles that we all know that I suspect we all have experiences of having been in arguments where both people in the argument walk away more convinced of their position than when they started, and that happens a lot in almost all of the things that we do at the Museum of the Earth. And so the approach to thinking about energy is grounded in some of that, and thinking about the Marcellus, and trying to develop this community approach to deeper understanding and more civil communication about it. And it involves as many different kinds of educators as we can.
So this is Tamara. I have a more general question. A lot of you talked in some ways about involving educators in the formal setting and in the informal setting, working with each other to then conduct an activity, which for the most part sounded to me like that was conducted in the informal context. Do you have examples or have thought about ways that some of what comes out of it is then brought into the formal context?
This is Louise. One of the things that happened in one of our climate summits out in North Carolina was we had a mix of formal and informal educators who came to the workshops, the educator workshops, and then they work with students. The way our summits work is that we had it set up that the teachers would then work with their kids in their classrooms, have them do research projects, and bring them to the summit and present their research. In North Carolina, we had about half of them were informal educators, and what they did then was went and found classrooms of where they would be welcome to come in. They worked with students in the classrooms with the formal educator, worked with them because they had the training with the materials, brought in the climate change resources, did the activities with the kids in classrooms, and then worked with them and brought them, the informal educator actually brought them to the summit. That was one example. Another example was an informal educator who went to homeschooled students and worked with them and did the same thing.
We have one that's percolating. The Binghamton cohort for the Marcellus Project has had one meeting last month, and we have our next meeting a week from today. And that cohort includes more teachers than our Elmira cohort, including three teachers and sort of more, three teachers from Binghamton Regents Prep Academy, which is an alternative school essentially for kids who are on the cusp of dropping out. And the teachers that are that are officially members of the cohort are the earth science and the environmental science and biology teacher, environmental and biology being the same teacher, and an English teacher. And the social studies teacher wants to come, but they're a very small school, and they can't have the whole staff go out on one day for the workshop. So I'll actually be working with them to think about ways to teach the Marcellus Shale and energy across the curriculum. And we'll be working with the informal educators involved in the cohort as well. And I think using this as sort of my hope is anyway that we'll use this as kind of a focus problem of how to develop resources for with the classroom teachers working together with the informal educators to think about what it is that they will do and develop some lab materials as well. That's the example from the current project. We also have a transforming STEM learning proposal in that we haven't heard back about as yet, where the goal is, one of the goals is to have students producing materials for informal institutions and the informal institutions thinking about holes that they have in their exhibitry or in their programming that can be filled by students doing interesting things about the environmental science and earth system science within their community. So that's we hope that'll get funded, but we think it's a really cool idea.
I know that your project, David, your project is focused mostly on communicating using media. Are there examples that you've encountered in that effort, bringing it back into the classroom?
I'm not quite sure. It's about communication, but it's also about engagement. It's about engaging a population with ideas, because the print media that is created, it has an electronic interactive component so that people can engage with it in real time using smartphones. And so it becomes like a mobile exhibit. And people can read it, they can engage with it, they can text, they can talk to other people through it, they can become connected to community, they can learn about coordinated events at local informal science institutions that are going to have classes or opportunities. They can learn about local school districts, projects, and public showings. All of which are meant to bring people together around climate change science and understanding the basic science of climate change. So this is the first time where we are working to try and involve the schools, because we want teachers and students talking and learning about climate change science, and we see that as a possibility in any of their classes. We see, you know, how do you adapt climate change for a history class? How do you adapt it for math class? How do you use it in science? How do you use it in English? So we'd like to see the level of discourse. We'd just like to see its presence greater. So our goal is to stimulate conversation in the public schools in informal classroom settings while we're engaging the greater public.
One other thing that we've done that we've had really good success with was working with trying to get information out to rural teachers who have to travel too far to get to the workshops. We worked with informal educators involved in 4-H in Virginia, and they would come to the site for the workshop and then go back out, and they work with the school districts out in rural areas in Virginia. So then those informal educators with 4-H would go out and actually work with teachers in the classroom on climate change activities and things like that, getting students ready, and then actually bringing students to the summit. So that was actually a really successful piece that we were able to work out between formal and informal in Virginia.
Very good.
This is Karen. I have a question for all three of you and maybe others. And I'm thinking of both the National Governors Association report on informal education and the work that the National Research Council has done. And the findings from both of those have shown the value of informal education in the affective domain, changing people's interest in, enthusiasm for, in this case, climate change science or energy science that you're talking about as a subject. So far you've talked mostly about informal educators as carriers, disseminators of professional development. Have any of you thought and in your programs used the informal-formal connection to foster more affective kinds of learning through the informal institutions and then more cognitive learning through formal, and trying to see where the connections of those two kinds of learning are?
This is Caroline Lewis, and I think the Fairchild Challenge probably has a ton of that going on. It's launched from a public garden or a zoo or a museum, and it's pitched to the formal education, but it has so much voluntary informal learning that then seeds further formal classroom learning by interdisciplinary teachers that I think it speaks to what you're saying about really where that intersection between the two is very fertile and provokes both the affective and cognitive learning that's going on. I'm trying to do the same thing with the CLEO project now, where it's aimed at society at large, but it's using high school and college kids to sort of spearhead the initiatives in their communities and in their schools. And I'm finding tremendous overlap in what you're saying, what you're asking about the affective. It's like the affective is the hook that gets them to want to be more ingrained. So I appreciate what the third David, who said about this is an engagement tool, too, because, you know, I'm big on casting wider nets on engagement that feeds more interest in learning. So I don't know if that answers your question, but I didn't want to get away from a suggestion for all of you who are holding great forums with informal and formal educators in multiple disciplines. And I had a summit in January with teachers and scientists and community leaders and elected officials and the whole nine yards, and put through this whole climate change engagement stuff and get them riled up. And I had tremendous success in building collaborations with one little exercise that took 20 minutes. And I gave everybody a sheet with three columns. And the columns were strategy, audience, and partners. And I made them reflect on their education and engagement strategies on climate change, audiences they're reaching and not reaching, and partners they are working with or would like to work with. And then I made them, like, in little groups, sort of pick an audience they would like to reach and then think about a strategy and a partner in the room or outside that they wanted to work on. And then we flipped it, and everybody picked a partner they'd like to work with and thought about the audience and strategy they would use with that partner. And then we did the third one where they started with a strategy. They had never tried a science cafe or a leadership forum or something. And then what audience would they tackle? And this exercise gave the 48 participants in the room something to go home with and follow up on collaborating and expanding. So I give that to you as an exercise. It took 20 minutes, but had people leaving with tangible excitement about their next steps.
I like that. Might use it in our workshop next week.
No, it works. It works, and it's quick.
Yeah,
together at the end, all the conversations they had been having.
Well, one part of my answer to Karen's question about the affective versus scientific approach is, I'm not sure if that's quite the label you used, but something like that. And we're actually dealing with that up close and personal, I guess, because we're in the process of merging the Paleontological Research Institution and its Museum of the Earth, the Paleontological Research Institution now in its 80th year. The museum opened in 2003, but both the larger institution and the museum within it are fairly science-focused. The Paleontological Research Institution, for most of its 80-year history, is exactly what it sounds like, paleontologist studying ancient life. The Museum of the Earth is built around partly around the intersection of science and art and how to use art to communicate science, but it's still very science-focused. The Cayuga Nature Center, which we're in the process of merging with, is pretty much a traditional nature center, which has a more effective approach to what it's doing. And we're trying to benefit from each other's strengths as we work together in this merger, which is essentially complete. It's not complete in the eyes of New York State and in the eyes of all the paperwork being filed and so forth, but essentially the merger between the two institutions is operational, and it's interesting bringing these different flavors of educators together. So that's a little different from your question, but relevant.
Dawn?
Mm-hmm.
This is Jane Heinz-Fry talking, and I will grab your email off of some of our communications, and I'd just like to follow through with you, having been a teacher in upstate New York and having both your institution and Cornell and taking kids to Cayuga Nature Center, I would be glad to follow through with you in more detail in a separate communication.
Great.
Okay?
Great. Yep. My email is also on the first slide in my presentation on the site.
Great. Thank you.
Yep. Thank you.
Are there other questions?
Yeah, I have a question. This is Frank. This is always an interesting conversation, and I would ask us to think a little bit more about the intersection between formal and informal. And the other aspects that we haven't talked about that go into, as John Miller calls, civic science literacy. We haven't talked about religious. We haven't talked about parents and children as much, and scientific interest and college, the role of college in this, because it is a form of formal education, but it clearly has a strong weight on civic science literacy. And the time scale on some of the conversations seem to be very short term, and this is a lifetime process. And so, I mean, I'd be interested just to see, how do we move this model of the interplay of these modes together in a richer way that more of us kind of see it in a common way. I'm being very ambiguous here because it's a long and weighty conversation, and an hour is kind of short, but I've been waiting for this conversation to kind of get a little bit meatier for a long time, and I'm just wondering what's the next step, because it's rich.
Well, we could possibly think about how these different, we could potentially have it continue this conversation where we specifically target different communities that we would like to explore, because I think it is very complex, and addressing it in a broad way in one conversation, I don't think it's really going to get at it. But if you want to think about, one example is you mentioned is religious communities. There we could potentially have a separate panel discussion in which we have examples of how people have engaged that in that kind of conversation. Through both the formal and informal, if there's an integration with informal and formal education.
But who's the gentleman who's doing the David who's doing the bus?
Oh, that's David. Me, David Lustig.
So, one of the things that's interesting there is you're reaching out to an audience that is not necessarily represented through these normal modes.
Correct.
And so you're expanding the, and this is actually to the heart of what John Miller did in 2010 at the Aztec community, was saying that the tools and expertise of the formal and informal education community need to kind of change the way they work, because bringing people through the doors isn't necessarily the best way to deal with these kinds of issues. And so are there ways to change the field so it's more engaging and widening the base?
If I can follow on that, I think that is one of the motivating factors for our work, is that we see informal science education in untraditional ways. We've tried to see that really informal learning takes place 24/7. In terms of teachers, you know, science teachers are always concerned about what students are coming into their class with, you know, in terms of their ideas, their preconceptions, their misconceptions, their alternative conceptions. And they are nearly one of the biggest ways that those conceptions are formed. We would love to think that it had to do with their science education in formal settings. But the fact of the matter is that most of these kids are coming in with ideas about the world that are, they're learning in an informal manner. And I don't mean just in museums. I mean they're learning them on the radio. They're learning about them surfing the web. They're learning about them by listening to TV, by watching movies, by listening to other people talk, all of which are opportunities for informal learning. So people are learning informally whether we want them to or not. And the question becomes, how do we influence and shape what those learning opportunities might look like? Mass media is a very powerful machine. It dominates most of modern society. So the challenge for informal science educators is to understand the tools of the medium and understand how is it that we can use this to broaden the and enrich the science learning opportunities for people regardless of their age, across their lifespan. And I know, you know, the incredible work and the role that museums are doing, but the fact is that not everybody goes to museums, though surveys have shown that a high percentage of Americans have visited a museum, a science museum or science center in the last year. So I just see it as a wide-open opportunity where all these people have time while they're commuting, that we could enrich it instead of selling them products and services, give them opportunities to engage with science. The biggest challenge I see is how do the model, a sustainable model for funding such opportunities.
Right. Because the hardest thing to do is quantify informal learning. It has been my nemesis for 10 years now in creating great programs, and it's extremely hard when no two people are getting the same thing pre, post, and informal education, because, like David just said, they're learning it in all of these other vehicles and opportunities you're creating. It is hard to sustain funding for these wide net infusion of conversation and some good hooks for people. It's very hard to keep them funded. Or to get them funded, much less keep them funded. So,
both.
But Frank, what are you thinking? I mean, do you see zoos, gardens, museums as platforms for more disengagement in terms of their communities, or are they too one-dimensional in who they attract? Are we looking at scientists getting out more in senior center homes and having conversations? I mean, it's wide open. The media is a tool we all try to use, but we're missing a huge piece of society when we don't recognize what I think David just said about all these forums for conversation and learning that are happening, and how do we identify the ones that are missing some of what the people on this phone call can bring to it, and how do we get them out there?
So, I mean, the two takeaways that I would say is that the really missed opportunities is dialogue is an incredibly powerful tool that is woefully underutilized. And there's many ways to do that, but that is, you know, that's one finding, and I can give you some reasons why. And the second one is the if you are engaging somebody, imagine a national park ranger in Glacier National Park talking to a visitor. And they're talking about glaciers. They're standing there looking at them, and they interpretive programs are supposed to stimulate learning. And they stimulate learning. Where does the learner go? It's the handshakes or the connections between learning opportunities that I think is an area where the pathways between formal and informal, between children and adults, between adult learners and, you know, friends and colleagues. It's those connections that we haven't really tended to as skillfully as I think we could. That's because why I'm really interested in this conversation is because the work that we have to do has to start building those pathways in a learner that none of us can do by ourselves. But we're not, you know, handshaking between my initiative and the next one. We're starting to do that through this network, but I don't think we're as mature as I think we could be.
Yeah, I think that's a really good point, and I think that's what we started to try to address with just what is the handshake between formal and informal by having this conversation. So we are at just about 2 o'clock Eastern time.
But can I just say, on a big picture scale, Tamara, I think that the hearing the speakers today, there is optimism that the wheels are turning in a lot of individual places and places that are overlapping. And I think this kind of conversation where we could share tools, strategies, and maybe define some broader open-ended targets, this conversation should continue. And this toolkit of strategies, or whatever we want to call it, and engagement tools or whatever, they really speak to this next step we need. I mean, I am so proud of the Clean Portal and the resources, the peer-reviewed resources that are available. It's now getting them out and getting people to want to play with them who are not necessarily part of a formal education class where the teacher is using it. So I am very happy on today's conversation that we started the ball rolling, but I'm in agreement with the previous speaker. This is just the beginning, and hopefully we'll have more.
Yes, I absolutely agree with you. And we actually started that conversation a bit at the end of the Clean review camp we had here today. We actually asked all of the participants to sort of give us their ideas for how we might market or broadly disseminate Clean, both the materials and the conversation. So I think that this panel discussion was a good start, and if people have comments on how it's run or put together, I'd like to hear them, but I think that we'll move forward with doing these in the future, and we can broaden this conversation around the topics that were brought up today.
Great.
Are there any more comments or questions?
Thanks to all of you for your preparation for initiating the conversation.
Absolutely. Yeah,
thank you.
Okay. All right. Thanks a lot. And we'll be sending out an email. Next week, Steve Schneider is going to be talking about the Urban Climate Education Partnership. And we'll be sending out the information about a Google Docs that people can start accumulating their comments about the new draft national standards and moving forward in that conversation within the Climate Literacy Network.
Sounds good.
Thanks.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thanks, everyone.
Bye, everybody.
Bye-bye. Bye-bye.